And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
During his 2024 State of Higher Education Address, Commissioner Chris Lowry reflected upon higher education policy as well as programmatic successes. This year's address focused on the Commission's collaborative efforts to improve college enrollment, completion, graduation retention, and research outcomes over the past 12 to 18 months. During the address, Commissioner Lowry outlined how the Commission is addressing the challenges and opportunities facing higher education in Indiana through the HOPE agenda, Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. Additionally, he revisited recent legislative victories from the 2023 and the 2024 sessions and shared early indicators of those strategic initiatives. Commissioner Lowry, as you're crisscrossing the state sharing some of the highlights from your 2024 State of Higher Education Address, I thank you for joining us here at our Lakeshore Public Media Studios.
Dee, thank you for having me here. I'm just delighted to be with you today.
Commissioner Lowry, so you're in the region today spreading the gospel, if you will, following your 2024 State of Higher Education Address earlier this month. And I want to say, no pun intended, but you had a lot of good news to share with Hoosiers. I want to spend our time today going through a few of the updates as well as successes. But before we unpack a few highlights, take a moment to introduce yourself to our listening audience. And if you don't mind, include details regarding your role with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education.
Dee, thanks so much. Yes, my name is Chris Lowry, and I am just barely 2 years into serving in this role. I have a background in higher education and in business and public policy. So, you know, this seemed like a great fit at this point in my career. I spent about 8 years with Ivy Tech Community College, actually stood up and then led their workforce side of the college there with President Sue Elsperman. Prior to that, I was in industry for 20 years, where I gained a lot of experiences, including workforce development. And prior to that, as my adult children would say, I was a policy wonk. They might just say a nerd. And so all of those things kind of come together here. But yeah, our role at the commission is to serve as the coordinating body for all of our public institutions, all seven of the public institutions and the regionals and so forth, and then to work very closely with our private institutions. In fact, today I'm going to be spending some time visiting with folks in up here in the region in higher education, but also to spend time with employers. I try to make a concerted effort to spend time with employers, folks in K-12, community and faith-based organizations, and our role at the commission, my ultimate responsibilities include helping to set the strategy for higher education in Indiana, and we also have management responsibility for our state's portfolio of need-based financial aid. It's about a $400 million portfolio, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. Again, last week, in your role as the commissioner with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, you gave an address, and reflections included the 2024 Indiana legislative session, and you highlighted a few early indicators of success. And going back for just a moment, in 2023, the commission announced its HOPE agenda to position Indiana as a top 10 state by 2030. Let's go through just a few of the improvements as part of the HOPE agenda, which outlines seven goals. Starting with college enrollment, region policymaker State Representative Earl Harris Jr. authored House Enrolled Act 1449 during the 2023 Indiana legislative session, which now auto enrolls all 8th grade students into the 21st Century Scholars Program. Walk us through why this single piece of legislation will improve college enrollment and affordability.
You have literally hit on my favorite topic in my 2 years of having served in this role. Representative Harris, been a friend for a long time, and his leadership on this was just absolutely extraordinary. So I'll tie this together. 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago after I arrived, we started identifying and really pointing out, frankly, with a lot of noise, that our college going rate or enrollments, especially of high school seniors, had been declining. And it had been declining for a decade, down from about 68% to 53%. And to me, and then as we started talking about it, it was very alarming to folks. you know, and when you pull those numbers apart, it was even worse, if you will, that it was even more alarming when we looked at the fact, I think at that time, the college going rate was only 43% for black students, 44% for Hispanic students, 15-point difference between young men and young women, young wow. men being lower, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. And then for low-income students, it was 30%. However, low-income students who were part of the 21st Century Scholars Program, only difference being that they had been brought into the 21st Century Scholars Program, you know, through high school, their college going rate is 81%. That's amazing, right?
Phenomenal.
Yeah, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Higher than almost any category other than a couple of really small categories of you know, students that have completed the Indiana College Corps and things like that. Mm-hmm. So really good success. Well, Representative Harris and I talked, and then we started talking with folks, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, policy leaders, et cetera. And as I was talking to our team, you know, I said, so tell me about where we are with 21st Century Scholars. And they said, hey, Chris, you know, it's been around for 30-some years, which I knew, but we were only getting about half the kids who are eligible enrolled.
Right.
And a child has to be enrolled by the end of their eighth grade year, which is technically June 30th of that school year. And so, you know, Representative Harris pushed this. We got, frankly, this was one of my favorite things about this, D. We had wide support from Democrats, from Republicans, from urban, from rural, from suburban. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've pointed to it several times beyond the most important thing about it, which is that a lot of kids are going to get helped now and right. get the opportunities that many of us have had. It also just showed to me a different spirit that we don't hear or see often enough in sort of a divisive time we have. Mm-hmm. So I'll set that aside. Maybe that's another topic for another interview someday, Dee.
Yeah. But
what we did was we made the case for it. You know, certainly there would be an increase in the expenditures, but we were only getting about half of the kids.
Right.
And the first time someone said to me, well, Chris, you know, here's what the additional expenditures will be, I said, you know, okay, that's interesting, but what you're not telling me is the rest of the equation. And so we did a return on investment analysis, and not really surprisingly, right, what we saw, very conservatively estimated, is that over the life of these extra children who would be brought into this because they already qualified, their wages, just the difference in their wages over their lifetimes, would be more than 10% of our original investment.
Wow.
And the increase in tax receipts,
wow.
state and local, over that time would more than pay for the original investment, right? So this
wow.
this just became exactly wow.
Yeah,
you know,
I never considered that. That's
yeah,
interesting.
It was really breathtaking to us. Mm-hmm. And so, kind of to cut to the chase, it passed. I think it was unanimous, or might have had a stray no vote here and there, maybe in a committee or something like that. But just it was widely embraced, and I think no one had really felt that, you know, we could gain momentum to do something like this. I didn't even know it had really been discussed other than just passing conversations over
right.
the years. But here's the impact. This is what has happened. So we have to enroll these children, these young people, by the time they're finished being eighth graders. In 2022, the year before this passed, we only enrolled about 20,000 students statewide. And that was less than half of the kids eligible.
Right.
In 2023, on June 30th, I literally have chills thinking about it and talking about it. Every time I do, we enrolled over 46,000 kids. So from 20,000 the previous year to over 46,000
right.
the next year. And I mean, I literally think of this every day, because there are young people who are going to have these opportunities. You know, during high school, if people are familiar with the 21st Century Scholars Program, they get support to be good students, good citizens, expectations like filing the FAFSA, having a college and career plan, keeping a minimum GPA, you know, just, you know, keeping your nose out of trouble. You know, like I say, good citizen, good student stuff. And then the promise of this is you will receive full tuition and some other fees to go to one of our public institutions, same level of funding if you go to a private. And what's so great about it is the ability then for the students to get other additional grants and scholarships that, you know, in most instances, it pays for everything, room, right. board, et cetera. So it's, you know, an economist had some writing on this not long after it passed. These are his words, not mine, but I think he may be right.
Mm-hmm.
He referred to it as the most significant piece of economic development legislation in the state of Indiana in over 50 years.
Yes.
And you know, I agree. It, you know, human development, human capital development, you know, it's good for the person, it's good for employers, it's good for communities in our entire state. So it truly is one of the, well, it may be the best thing I've ever been involved in my now 40-year professional career.
One thing I think about regarding Hoosiers is this shift in changing careers, returning to school to level up, if you will. And one more goal from the HOPE agenda I would like to talk about is this priority for adult learners. Can you spend some time talking more about how adult learners can receive credit for prior learning?
Yeah, and I'm so glad, again, you pointed that out. And thank you for saying a few different times about the HOPE agenda. I have to say really quickly for your audience, it's an acronym. It stands for Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. And probably won't have time today, but there's so many documented facts that economically and socially people benefit from, you know, every increase of level of training and education, you know, from wages to unemployment to, frankly, life expectancy, infant mortality, you know, unemployment, labor participation rates, the whole nine yards. It just statistically improves with each level of training and education. So, you know, back to your question, though, about adults, we decided to place a very serious focus, along with enrollment and along with completions and then graduate retention, two really key and interrelated areas that we decided to place a focus on were getting more Hoosier adults back in the game, you know, whether they had had any training or education after a high school diploma, or even if they had some degree and then realized, oh, I need to know more about technology. That might be me as an example. I have somebody who's literally helping tutor me on AI because I don't know what I don't know. And so with this focus, we said, let's really put an emphasis on adults, including funding that's available, you know, grants and scholarships like our adult student grant, workforce ready grant, you know, and the like. But then also focus on some specific populations. We have chosen to focus on veterans and individuals in the military, those with disabilities, and the justice involved. The reality is, in each of those areas, they don't get as much attention as statistically they really need. In fact, less so than the broader adult population. And yet, the results when they receive training and education are really good. You know, vastly, they're great. You know, they're great employees, very focused, you know, want to do well, and so forth. So, coupling up to that, there has been something called credit for prior learning that's been around for a number of years, but frankly, not really leveraged, not leveraged in Indiana and only leveraged sparingly around the country. Credit for prior learning is, you know, to sort of simplify it, it is taking and quantifying what an individual has learned, what their knowledge is through any credit or through different forms of prior training or education and also work experiences. So I'll give you some examples. You know, in my instance, in 20 years in industry, we did a lot of different training, you know, including on lean manufacturing and human resources and strategy and so forth. And so that's an example where someone may have received training, you know, in their place of employment or maybe even formally, you know, a certification program, say in manufacturing, a certified production technician. But then also through their work experiences have learned, you know, a lot of what might otherwise be captured in curriculum and in a degree. So credit for prior learning helps an institution, higher ed institution, and then the individual quantify those things and say, hey, this will count for X number of hours with the college. So I'll use the one example. I mentioned certified production technician. It's a national thing, a certification that folks can get in the manufacturing environment. I think I've got this right, that transfers directly into Ivy Tech, I believe, for 9 credit hours toward, you know, different programs. That's amazing. That's, you know, that's 3 classes that someone then would not have to take.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've pointed to a friend of mine who were almost the same age. In his instance, he and some relatives started a business about 40 years ago, about the time I was finishing my undergrad. He didn't go to he didn't go to traditional college. But over the years, he and his family built a business that employs about 1,500 people, about $250 million in revenue, you know, 2 or 3 states here in the U.S. They're also in Mexico. And he's literally like done everything in the company except be legal counsel and probably not CFO because they probably have had certified accountants, but literally has done all of that. Mm. And yet, the way it has been for years, if he just decided, hey, you know what, I want to get a business degree, he would show up and someone would say, here are the list of all the entry-level courses you need to take. Right. And the reality is he could probably run the department.
He could run.
Right.
Exactly.
Because he's done marketing and operations and logistics and transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a way of quantifying those work capabilities, various training. And up until just about a month and a half ago, only 8 states in the nation had essentially a strategic plan and framework to leverage credit for prior learning for adult learners, you know, going back to or continuing their education. Now Indiana is the 9th. Our team spent the better part of a year with our friends in the academia and employers and others forming this really great strategic plan and framework. And so we'll be, you know, pushing that out and implementing it with our partners in higher ed. And the long and the short of it is it helps an adult learner, you know, accelerate their end goal of that, you know, credential, that degree, and also in the process, obviously saving time, saving money, you know, quantifying their capabilities, so then they're that much more marketable in the workforce.
Now, Commissioner, I want to spend some time speaking about the Indiana pre-admission strategy. I'm so excited to talk about this because I understand that this new initiative will have a profound and proactive approach to college enrollment in the Hoosier State, beginning with the inaugural class of 2024. So can you spend some time just kind of unpacking what that is?
Hitting some of my favorite topics today, Dee. This all ties back to that enrollment goal we were talking about, right? We had seen such a precipitous decline. Other states had. Ours was just steeper than, well, any of us would like. So we started thinking about proven solutions and challenges that might exist for enrollment. And literally talking as a team one day, I know I made kind of a glib comment, but it really was how I felt, that you know, the broader marketplace for the consumer of higher education is challenging. You know, if you think about it, here you're likely to spend, whether of your own funds or, you know, grant and scholarship funds, et cetera, you're likely to spend tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you've got a few institutions in mind because, well, those are the ones you know about.
Right.
And so you don't know about all the other institutions that might be applicable. And then you go through this process of applying and all the stuff that goes with that, and then you wait. You literally wait to see, will they actually take me, and just to be blunt about it, my money,
right,
to do what I want to do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we're having this conversation, and you know, we all agree, you know, the marketplace just isn't really as consumer-friendly as it could be. Well, we started digging into it and said, how could we make it better? And as we were forming our ideas, we found out that the state of Idaho was doing something basically like what I'll explain in a second is our pre-admission strategy. We were the third in the nation to do this. Idaho, and I think Minnesota was second. Now we're the third, and others, by the way, others starting to follow us. essentially, what we've done is go to all the public and private institutions, and we did so very quickly for this year's cohort of students. We actually thought about launching this in August of 24, and my response to our team was, no, let's run. Let's don't look for perfect this year. Let's get as close as we can, but let's run. Mm-hmm. So we went to our public and privates and said, hey, you tell us, give us a threshold GPA and or SAT that would, you know, constitute admissions to your, you know, to your institution. And then we were able to work with the Department of Education and local schools to say, hey, now we need that data. Basically, all juniors in high school take the SAT. So got the scores right there.
The scores.
And now this coming year, we'll actually have all the GPAs because it's been, you know, put on an electronic platform.
Okay.
We actually went to all the high schools last year in a very, very short notice. And long story short, we captured about 80% of all of the higher ed institutions in Indiana and about 75% or 80% of the kids.
Wow.
Well, at this point, and of course, I'm not the, you know, tech genius at all. That's fortunately, we have really smart people who do that. You know, it's a matter of matching up the data, right? And so in September, we started sending for the very first time in Indiana letters to the homes, electronic communication and letters to the homes of every single, you know, of these high school students. Now, again, it was about 80% of them this year, around 57,000. This fall, this September, we'll send it to all seniors, and that's around 75,000. But the letter is pretty simple. You know, it said, hey, you know, it was congratulating them. And then it provided a list of every single public and private institution, and again, about 80% participated with us, to which you would be pre-admitted. And I got to tell you, I had no idea sort of what the reaction would be. And I pretty quickly found out. I was sitting in a meeting, I think, mm-hmm. the first time something came through. And I don't know how to put it, my phone started to blow up. Text messages, calls, emails from people I didn't even know.
Wow.
Saying, this is amazing. The average student found out that she or he would be pre-admitted to 24 institutions in Indiana, schools
wow.
they'd never heard of. You know, so I think about up here, the folks I'm going to be visiting with today, you know, that say a kid in Southern Indiana suddenly learned about Purdue Northwest, or they learned about Calumet College, or right? You know, they learned that these other places are there, and, you know, by gosh, they would be admitted.
Right.
As many as 38, there were as many as 38 that participated, counting all the regionals. And, you know, there were some students who actually found out 38. And just to find out then from parents and then some of the kids, I mean, I have people coming up all the time and saying, hey, the most recent one was one who said, hey, my kid was going to go to this school in Ohio. He's not going there now.
Right.
And
right.
told me the three that he had narrowed it down to right here in Indiana. So, right, it's keeping the talent here, making education more accessible, and then through 21st Century and our other grants and things, also making it more affordable.
Now, Commissioner, I want to shift for a moment and talk about the 2024 Indiana legislative session in regards to higher education. Are there any notes that you would like to share regarding the session in regards to higher education?
I would. And building off of some of those priorities, and again, thanks for mentioning, you know, some of those key goals in the HOPE agenda, but building off of some of those, we received, again, really broad support. There was one primary bill that contained four different things in it that the way I've been looking at it, you know, our ultimate goal is to improve educational attainment, you know, post the high school diploma, whatever training and education that might look like, because again, economically and socially, the outcomes are just better. But you know, so improve the attainment for individuals. But in the process, our primary focus this year was on access and affordability. So building on things like the pre-admissions, 21st Century Scholar, the expansion we did of the 21st or of the Frank O'Bannon grant for low-income students and, you know, those various things. So four components to it. The first was to look at our Indiana College Corps. I'll make that really quick. The Indiana College Corps has been around about 12 years, and it's a block of 30 credit hours of dual credit that high school students can take. You know, and it came about because a lot of times what happens is students kind of collect what we think of as random acts of dual credit. And they're learning, obviously, and it's good that they're learning and so forth. But it's even more important to know that those can fully transfer to a college or university. And so this was created about 12 years ago. As a sidebar, when I came into the role about 2 years ago, I was stunned to find out that only about 84 of our high schools out of more than 500 in Indiana actually offered the full core. They would offer a lot of dual credit, but you know, getting it down to that. And the reason that's so important is, yeah, by law, that the public institutions have to fully accept that block of 30 hours. Well, that's a whole year's worth of college. And now many of our privates accept it because, well, it makes sense, right? The marketplace is working. And we put an immediate emphasis on that. And I challenged our team to move it up as quickly as possible toward at least 500. Well, that was April 2022. By August, now it's taken 10 years to get to 84. By August, we were up at 149.
Wow.
By this past August, we were up to 222. And by this coming August, we expect to be up around 300. Well, this bill takes it one step further, and it requires all high schools to either offer it or to report back to the commission on what the barriers are and what their plan of implementation would be. So it's such a gift to young people that if they can leave high school with this full year, they're more likely to enroll. They're much more likely to complete. And, you know, of course, I'm crossing my fingers. I hope they stay in Indiana then when they do.
No brain drain, right.
Yeah. So that was the first component. The second component is really interesting. It's called reverse transfer. I'll give you an example. Let's use Ivy Tech locally. If someone is pursuing, say, their associate degree, and then they transfer to, say, Purdue Northwest, but they don't finish their associate degree, say they've taken 45 hours out of 60 hours. They go ahead and transfer because they want to, and mm-hmm. that's the next best step for them. However, when they are at, say, Purdue Northwest, and Purdue Northwest has just been such a great partner. Maybe I'll say another four institution. if they complete the hours there that they would have at Ivy Tech, right, they would have what would on paper constitute an associate degree. So this puts in place a mechanism to do that reverse transfer. So for the four-year institution to essentially reverse those hours back to the two-year college so that student can get an associate degree. You know, sometimes people ask, so why is that important? Well, the fact of the matter is, even when someone transfers to that next level and says, hey, I'm going to go ahead and transfer even though I haven't completed this associate degree, many times they still don't complete and don't get their bachelor's degree.
Makes sense.
Right?
Makes sense.
In this instance, rather than transferring, not getting the bachelor's degree and not having anything, they have that associate degree. So again, it's just so logical. And this puts a mechanism in place for us just to broadly do that. The third element is really, really interesting. We've got frankly, we've had national media calling us saying, hey, what are you doing with this? It's called Degree in Three. Purdue has done some of this. Ball State has. Others have, but it hasn't been a state priority. And what this does is it requires our state public institutions to look at their various programs and determine what degrees could possibly be done in 3 years rather than four.
That's a game changer.
Right. You reduce the time, you reduce the money, you get into the marketplace sooner. Mm-hmm. And so, every institution is going to report back and say, hey, here's how we're going to do it. Here are the ones we're going to do. And of course, we hope that sort of the velocity increases and we'll be tracking it very closely that more and more will offer that. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't be a requirement for a student to do it in 3 years, but mm-hmm. rather an option that is very clearly defined of how to go do that. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is very similar to sort of that reverse transfer that I was describing in this context. We know that in spite of Indiana's completion rate, so going to and finishing college, while it's really been improving over the years, we're 11th best in the nation now. I'm pleased with that. Of course, I want us to be a top 10. But even while it's been improving, broadly, a lot of students still don't complete. And and that's just a shame. If they started a four-year institution, maybe get three-quarters of it done, and life gets in the way, right? A family member is sick. That individual gets sick. A host of things we know are real life barriers. What this allows us to do is to work with the four-year institutions. We'll do a study to see what the advisability and feasibility would be for those four-year institutions to offer an associate degree. So and where it would mostly apply is, the student who says, again, hey, I'm going to go for my bachelor's of science, life gets in the way, they can't get back, mm-hmm. but yet they've done enough credits, 60 hours, mm-hmm. To constitute an associate degree. And rather than them just leaving, maybe with debt, no credential, mm-hmm. this challenges all of us to say, would it be advisable and really study this to look at that side of the equation? Sort of another bill, it wasn't exactly a companion bill, also does the opposite, not really the opposite, but also complements it. And that has us, along with our two-year institutions, especially Ivy Tech, to look at and say, what's the advisability and feasibility of them offering certain four-year degrees? And especially in those applied science areas like some of the things in manufacturing or nursing where there's such an incredible high demand. So those last two, we don't know what the outcome of that'll be, but it's the first time we've really made a pointed and concerted effort to look at it and say, how could this possibly help students?
In the few minutes or so that we have left, I understand that the Indiana Commission on Higher Education has gone through a bit of restructuring and reorganization. Can you share with our listening audience what that is?
Yes, I would love to. And sort of this is, sort of the backside of it. A couple of different things. As we launched this vision last year, we started following it immediately by what we refer to as a strategic management plan. So how do we go make this stuff happen? Honestly, I think too oftentimes in government and other places, big ideas are out there, but executing them, that's where things fall short. So we created this strategic management plan. It comes from industry and from private business, been developed by really world-renowned consultants, and we've adopted it. And it goes from our vision, the things you were talking about, to then the strategic goals in the HOPE agenda. Each one of those assigned to two senior associate commissioners, and then each initiative, and we talked about just a few here, go out to people within the organization. Ultimately, what we've done, and this has just been in this year, is each person, and we have a little over 60 people on our entire team across the state, each person now has at least three measurable goals for the year that relate back to one of those Hope Agenda goals. And, you know, part of it, yes, is about accountability, but also I've had the privilege of managing and leading people for a long time. It helps show people why they're there, that regardless of what they're doing, how it fits to the big goal, you know, and it feeds that passion. We've also realigned. We had a research team, really, you know, great work, but it often resulted in reports that were, you know, sort of stale data, and they, you know, mostly sat on a shelf. We reorganized that. We now have a business intelligence team, and we've moved from reports. You'll be seeing later this year an online, real-time updated dashboard for any Hoosier to access. I just don't want people who are, you know, mildly, you know, or who maybe have deep interest in this to get to this data and information. I want any Hoosier who wants to see it to see it, and maybe businesses and others who want to move to our state. So that is going to be coming online, and we're going to keep, because we need to, using some of the lagging data, because, you know, some of it comes out only like every, you know, it's like 2 years old when you get it. And that's very frustrating to me. So we're adding in things like leading indicators. You know, the college going rate is always a 2-year lag data, and that just makes me crazy. So that's why we're using the enrollment now too. By the way, I should mention this, first time in 13 years, enrollment was up this school year for colleges and universities in Indiana. 13 years. So awesome. We're pleased with that.
Yes.
And then we're beginning to forecast on all of these initiatives. So our fellow Hoosiers for whom we work will know, are these things working? Where are we on track? Where are we off track? And then the last thing is, I just have to tell you this, we started about a year ago implementing something we call the Partnership Pentagon. We went to leaders in 5 areas of our broad society and said, we want your help. We want you to push us, pull us, tell us to move fast, or tell us what we ought to be looking at. And so they're from 5 areas: government, education, business, nonprofit organizations, and specifically some I've mentioned today, community and faith-based organizations, and then philanthropy. Each of those areas is just, they're just so fundamental to civil society. And even beyond that, you know, I am absolutely convinced when each one of those 5 is working in concert, you know, it's not a total of 5 at the end. It's something much, much more, right? It's you know, it's something that's much more exponential when they come together. And we've been seeing that. They've been advising us. They're going to issue a report this summer of how to build on the Hope Agenda. And so we're eager for that. And then we're also doing a consumer study, the deepest one that's ever been done regarding higher ed on consumers here in Indiana. We'll also issue that this summer.
That is so exciting. You know, I could spend an additional hour speaking to you because, again, there's so much information to be shared from your office. And so I'm so excited that you're in the region today. So excited that you stopped by our studio. And I know that this will be probably the first of many conversations that we will have about all of the exciting news coming from your commission. So I thank you for swinging by Lakeshore Public Media Studios, and I look forward to having you again.
Dee, and I can't thank you enough, and I too hope this is only the first of our conversations.
Commissioner Lowry shared additional information, including how adult learners can earn credit for prior experiences. To hear the full interview, visit www.lakeshorepublicmedia.org. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. Nearly 78% of American adults are considered to be financially illiterate. More than half of Americans feel anxious thinking about their personal finances, and over 48% of Americans do not actively engage in any long-term financial savings plan. While many people think financial literacy means being able to balance a checkbook, it truly goes beyond being able to complete basic math skills. It's about making wise financial decisions to handle real-life situations. In honor of Financial Literacy Month, Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer recently joined us to share how we can all boost our financial IQ and confidence. Here's the conversation. Greg, we've talked about financial literacy this time last year, and I'll never forget that we discussed a study about people who earn $250,000 a year, and yet they still live paycheck to paycheck. So we see financial literacy impacts individuals at all income levels. This year, I would like to discuss how financial literacy affects people in real life situations. But I want to start with this. What is financial literacy?
Okay, good question, Dee. So financial literacy refers to learning key financial concepts to be financially smart and savvy so you can secure your financial future. Sometimes, you know, it gets confused with being financially responsible, but those are two different things. Responsible is about paying your bills on time, having a high credit score. But when you are financially literate, you don't lose money unknowingly or unnecessarily, and you know the right questions and to ask, and have a better awareness about just financial decisions.
Now, let me ask you this. What does it mean to be asset rich but cash poor?
Simply put, when a person or a couple owns a substantial amount of assets that are valuable, like real estate or investments, but they just don't have ready cash, you know, cash immediately available for use. That's what they call asset rich, cash poor.
Can you give some examples of being asset rich, cash poor that could be a negative?
Yeah, let's give you a simple example. Let's say a person, they own the residence outright, but they have an expensive repair, let's say a new roof. It could be a financial burden because they don't have the cash on hand. Another example could be a person who has a lot of their money tied up in investments like stocks and or real estate, but they don't have the emergency fund. So if the market's not doing well at a certain time, they don't want to pull out and they don't have ready cash available. So it's admirable to own all these investments and or real estate, and they're valuable and they're real money, but you also want to ensure that you have emergency savings for medical expenses, an expensive repair, an unexpected job loss, while also still continuing to contribute to those long-term financial goals like retirement and or health care costs like long-term care.
Now, speaking of liquidity, how much liquidity should you have access to quickly if needed?
It's always going to vary, Dee, because people have different comfort levels. But when we speak of liquidity, you know, we're talking about cash, you know, ready on hand, that emergency savings that you have access to if you need it quickly. There's different parameters. Ideally, if you work your way up to 12 months of cash to save up for your living expenses, just helps you feel a lot better, gives a lot of security, you know, about what things could happen and that are unexpected and how comfortable you are in that moment. And while 12 months may, you know, be a little daunting, you can start even saving a smaller amount, even a month of living expenses, then build up 3 months and 6 months, et cetera. But the longer you have that cash reserve, the more comfortable you're going to be about the day-to-day emotions and security about just your overall financial well-being.
I like that you added that you can take small steps, if you will, start off with a month, then 3 months, and work your way up. I think that sounds like a more attainable goal for our listening audience. For the past several years, inflation has most likely impacted many of our listeners today. Can you explain how financial literacy and inflation are related?
So simply stated, inflation is the increasing cost of goods and service over time. So, you know, in a good economy, generally, you're going to see inflation run around, you know, 2%. The pandemic, it was a lot higher. You reached areas of about 8.5% in 2022. And currently, it's running probably around 3.5%. But ultimately, because of inflation, your ability to buy goods and services decreases over time. For example, if you had $100 in your savings account, inflation rate is 5%. To buy the same things a year from now, you would need about $105 to purchase those goods.
Greg, I want to shift gears and talk taxes. You know, we pay them every April, and for many of us, we just paid them on April 15th. Whether we're doing our taxes ourselves or paying a tax professional to do our taxes, how does financial literacy help us in this area?
Well, and it's really about understanding. So tax preparation is all about looking backwards. You know, we call them the historian. You know, they're not going to change what happened last year. It's coming in, you're bringing all your paperwork to ensure that you have accurately paid your taxes for the year. And if you didn't, that's where the balance of the books began, right? Where tax planning is more about looking forward. Okay, what can we do to reduce, mitigate taxes that we would have in the future? So a perfect example of this is the current tax code, you know, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will expire after next year. And without an act of Congress, we go back to the old code. Well, that will entail higher tax rates. And even if there is an act of Congress, many people are predicting that they will be higher tax rates than the current tax code. So while these tax rates are historically low, we should be talking about strategies, especially with retirement accounts, to pay the lower rate. How do you do that, i.e. type Roth conversion, so that future withdrawals would be subject to a much lesser tax implication? And then, of course, the ongoing part is really what we call the tax management. You know, so all that stuff is just about being proactive, where even though we're not seeing necessarily the impact of withdrawals today, should we, so that in the future we'll experience less.
Now that you've convinced us that financial literacy really does affect all of us, no matter what your level is financially, what can people do to improve their financial IQ?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, first of all, understand that your financial house is going to be unique to you. So while your first financial go-to might be a friend or a family member to ask financial decisions that they've made in certain scenarios, you really want to learn how to make smart decisions for your circumstances. So there's a lot of things you can do. And my advice would be read not just one, but several different financial books. Look at free classes. There's a lot of them online. Or get educational events in the libraries that are no cost. Listen to podcasts. Talk to professionals. The key is to get information, learn from it, and simply start to take action.
And that was Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with Hammer Financial Group. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The United Way of Northwest Indiana invites community members interested in buying their first or next homes to their first-time home buyers vendors fair. Prospective buyers can explore home ownership opportunities and learn about down payment assistance programs, home financing, and mortgage pre-approval. The vendor fair, which is free, will take place this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Lake County Public Library in Merrillville. We recently had an opportunity to speak with Regional Development Director Kelly DeCamp. Here's the conversation. Kelly, so buying a home is always an exciting and exhilarating time for home buyers. But if you're a first-time home buyer, it can be a bit overwhelming because to some degree, there's a bit of anxiety, starting with the how. You know, how do you get started? How do you apply for financing? And also, how do you connect with a trusted real estate agent and a financial institution that will kind of help you walk through the process as well as advocate for you? So what exactly is the first-time home buyers vendor fair that your organization, United Way Northwest Indiana, is hosting? And why is it so important to our listening audience?
Yes. Well, thank you for that. We definitely are super excited to have this event. We've been talking about having it for a couple of years, and now finally it is happening. So the first time home buyer vendor fair is going to be for anyone that's in the market to, they're either a first time home buyer, or even if they're going to be looking for a second home or maybe downsizing, it's just going to be a room full of professionals that have dedicated their time to bring free information to people and help them with their process so that if they're not ready now, they're prepared in the future to know what they will need to buy their house. So we will have realtors there, home inspectors, insurance agents to answer any questions that people might have.
Kelly, why is the United Way Northwest Indiana holding this event? And to that point, what can first-time home buyers expect when in attendance at the fair?
United Way, we are about breaking down barriers to help residents build up their lives and their families. We have a strategic plan that clearly states that the United Way's mission is to help people thrive and bring the community together. And so we feel like our Level Up program is focusing not only on leveling people up, but helping them with all kinds of financial literacy. And what goes into that is savings account and stability for one's family and home ownership. So at this time, we have 12 graduates that are first-time home buyers, and we just want to help people get on that pathway.
So you mentioned the Level Up program, and I should share that I had the opportunity to speak with the United Way NWI President and CEO Adam O'Doherty some time ago about the Level Up program, and we spoke about how it focused on, among other things, access to community resources as well as financial education. And in that conversation, we spoke in great detail about the goal of planning for generational wealth. So is the first-time homebuyer vendor fair part of a bigger picture for the United Way?
Absolutely. So 2 years ago, our board of directors, led by Heather Ennis of the Northwest Indiana Forum, they came up with a strategic plan with four key areas. And with that, the first area of the strategic plan is to help reduce the number of families living below financial stability areas and helping people to buy their own homes. And so we know that the key to success is helping with generational wealth and security as far as owning a home. And so that is why we have branched out and said that we are going to have this first-time ever first-time home buyer vendor fair.
We here on Lakeshore Public Media, we air countless segments on inflation rates, rising mortgage rates, and even rising housing costs. So I have to ask you this, and I'm not sure if you actually have the answer to this, but I want to ask you this. Is now really the best time to buy a home?
You know, that's a great point, is that it's not really a question that I feel like I should answer. This is a room full of professionals. You're going to have realtors to tell you their opinion. You can have bankers that are going to tell you their opinion, and a financial advisor. And so whether you're looking to buy now or whether it's down the road, or maybe you just want that information to come in and talk to a professional and ask tips about down payment and is it something that is in your future, all these people are going to be in this room waiting for them to come in to answer those questions and give them that their free advice.
You mentioned this at the start of our conversation, and I noted it, that even though this event is called First Time Home Buyer Vendor Fair, you are also encouraging those in the region that are looking for their next home. What should we know about this vendor fair?
Yes, we would like, it's open to the public. So it is focused on first-time home buyers, but a lot of people don't know that if you haven't been in a mortgage for 3 years, that you're considered a first-time home buyer, so that there might be some different programs that are available for you. So it really is just a community effort to get information that people need about home ownership.
And I'm glad that you noted that, because a lot of homeowners think that they are not, quote unquote, first-time homeowners. So I'm glad that you noted that if you have been out of a mortgage for 3 years or more, that you are considered a first-time homebuyer. And again, there are so many more programs that are out that are available to help first-time homebuyers. And so I think that that is excellent. Now, Kelly, I do also want to note in my notes, I see that there will also be lots of opportunities to win prizes as well. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're excited that some of our vendors are happy to be at this event, and they have decided, we have one vendor that's giving away a 55-inch smart TV. Wynn Inspection is going to give away a free home inspection amongst other raffles. And then United Way, every half an hour, we're going to do a drawing for gift cards.
Kelly, you did mention this as well when you spoke about the board, but I wanted to remind our listening audience that the United Way Northwest Indiana was formed, again, almost 2 years ago following the merger of the Lake Erie United Way and United Way of Corridor County. Because it has been rebranded, if you don't mind sharing with our listening audience, what counties does United Way Northwest Indiana serve?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people do not realize that. So we cover 5 counties right now. We cover Lake, Porter, Newton, Jasper, and Stark counties.
Kelly, before I let you go, I would love for you to share information, including the full details of this upcoming event.
Absolutely. This is United Way First Time Home Buyer Vendor Fair. It's free and it's open to the public. The event is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. this Saturday, April 27th, at the Maryville branch of Lake County Library. We'll have tons of information, prizes, and more. Like I said, professionals from all kinds of different industries that are there just to answer your questions. So if you have a home maintenance question regarding something that's happening in your house, stop in and ask a professional and get free advice for that. With the more people that we can get in, the more people we can help, and we appreciate that. If you want more information, you can visit us on social media or at UnitedWayNorthwestIndiana.org.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from the United Way of Northwest Indiana, Kelly DeCamp, from the Indiana Commission on Higher Education, Commissioner Chris Lowry, and Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.